Hey there, you're listening to That's Absurd, Please Elaborate. This is a podcast where we answer strange, absurd, off-the-wall, outlandish questions from our audience using years of science communication research and the ability to read stuff.
You do not adjust your podcast. It's not on 2x speed. That was Trace just normal. You ever hit that button and you're like, oh, wow, they're talking really fast. No, Trace is just getting right to it today.
It's a busy week, okay? Jeez. I'm Trace Dominguez. I'm a science communicator, host of PBS's Stargazers. This is my co-host and friend, Julian.
Yep, I was just invited to this for some reason. Trace was like, let's make a science podcast. And I was like, I'm not doing anything. Yeah, sure, let's do it.
And then also today, we have a third person in our podcast, a science writer and producer based in D.C., the executive producer and co-host of Tiny Matters, a podcast from the American Chemical Society. Dr. Sam Jones, hello.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you for being on.
Dr. Jones.
Doctor, like, you know, I can tell you a lot about a very specific, you know, niche area of science. Cannot help anyone in like a plane emergency or anything really valuable.
Unless that plane emergency is specifically about something biomedical.
Like, what exactly, kind of plane emergency could you help out in? If the flight attendant comes running through the plane and is like, this is happening in
this
the cockpit.
Emergency.
We need a doctor. What's going to make you jump on your feet and be like, this is my moment?
Okay, like, is there a you need to know about a RNA degradation pathway that's very specific to neural development, and like I can help you.
Honestly, that sounds like a perfect alien thing. It's just like
the people down and the tower have snapped and they won't clear us for landing unless somebody has the answer to how this RNA degrades,
and then I will be the hero.
That's it, you will land this plane.
RNAs on a plane.
They're kind of snake shaped.
I like it.
Right?
Yeah, they're snakish.
They get all
kind of curly.
And...
yeah, I don't know.
I believe it.
Sam, can you tell me what the American Chemical Society is? I know what it is, but what is it?
Yeah, so it's a nonprofit scientific society based in D.C. It's actually, it's really big. I often compare it to something like AAAS for people who are listening that maybe know the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Make sure I have all those A's there.
That's a lot of A's.
So, you know, ACS does a ton of different things. Part of what they do is like public outreach, and that's kind of, or, you know, outreach more broadly. And so I'm in the communications division, but like really within a very small productions team, and then an even tinier Tiny Matters team, which is me, my co-host, Deboki. We have also an audio engineer, Michael Simonelli, and a fact checker. And that's it. Like, that's our, we have a little crew. But yeah, so ACS does a ton of things. A lot of it is specific to chemists and, you know, people, either academic chemists or chemists within industry. There's a whole section that does more general outreach.
It sounds very official. I'm surprised that you ended up here on our corner.
Yeah, what happened? Did the plane steer you to the wrong place and then on landing?
For people who haven't listened to That's Absurd, Please Elaborate before, typically each host or guest answers a question, like I mentioned at the top, from our audience. And this week, Julian is going to start with a question that we received from you, Sam.
Yeah.
So, Sam, do you remember exactly the question that you asked?
Oh, my gosh. It's so funny. I asked, and then I have not looked at it since.
I have the exact wording, but I'm going to need your state of mind you were in when you when you had this. So our question comes from one Dr. Sam Jones. It is, if all humans never had to poop again, how would it affect the world?
Yeah. Wow.
Dr. Jones, would you care to elaborate?
What can I say?
On your mindset?
I mean, I think, like, I'm always a lot of times fascinated by thinking of this, like, very important or essential thing that exists or that we do. And then, like, what if it just didn't exist anymore? And I think, you know, like, a lot of times our brains as humans, like, we go to gross things. We go to, like, I think poop is just, it's a thread throughout life, you know? Like, it's very important. We talk about it all the time. I will, like, spoiler alert, I'm going to talk about it a little bit in my answer to my question.
Good foreshadowing. I like that.
All I can say is it's a human fascination, and I wanted to know what would happen if it just didn't happen anymore.
It's true that I think we're naturally kind of drawn to the taboo, right?
Yeah.
Like, oh, we're not supposed to talk about it, but I want to know more. And I think because we're so often told not to think about it or look at it or anything, like, there's so many questions around subjects like this, because like there's a lot that just isn't generally known or understood because you're told not to. They don't look at the poo. Don't touch the poo. Don't do anything with the poo. Right.
Yeah.
Don't touch it. That's very specific as well.
Yeah. Julian has had this. We've talked about this before, Julian.
Don't touch it.
It's Julian. Just sitting
Julian.
There.
Julian.
It's just it's all warm. Okay. Right. So what if humans never had to poop again, which Trace and I like to go into like how the question is asked, right? And it's like the way you asked it wasn't like if we never had to poop in the first place. It's what if we never had to poop again? So like starting now, everybody listening, no more pooping.
Yes.
Then what? Okay.
Wow.
First of all, I'm going to assume that we don't have like a magical way to eliminate our need to poo, right?
Mm.
Like we can assume that later, but like right now, let's just assume it was just like some very anti-poo dictator comes to power and decrees across
everyone
the land.
Had a super banana that morning, right. And they're just like, that's
so
like, it.
So like biologically, we need to poop, but we just can't. Like we cannot do it. Okay.
Right. Exactly. So let's start with that assumption.
Oh, wow.
My brain didn't go quite that far in asking this question. Mm-hmm. And I feel like things are about to get very gross, but mm-hmm. please.
Yeah,
continue.
I mean, they are. But before we even get to that, I guess even more important, let's all have a, you know, like kind of a firm, like solid. Don't look at me like that.
What on the Bristol, chart? What, what are we talking?
It's just like a real solid.
In case you're not aware of the Bristol
kind of
chart.
Lump of understanding. Yeah, I don't know. Is it numbered?
It's numbered. Type 1 to 7. Yeah. 7 is a liquid consistency with no solid pieces.
Let's get a real type 1 understanding here.
Separate hard lumps.
Right.
Got it.
Of what is poo?
Ooh.
Right? Like, let's begin with that. I feel like people just assume that it's a certain thing.
Yeah.
And they're probably wrong. So, Trace, not having a doctorate in biomedical sciences, I'm going to feel like you're more likely to get this one wrong.
Oh, great. Thank you for setting me up for success.
This is turnaround is fair play. And the number of times you put me on the spot. Be grateful you're not doing it in haiku form.
That's true. Thank you for that.
What is poo?
It is the waste of us.
I mean, yes, but what
starring
is it
Pedro
made
Pascal.
Of?
Oh,
what
sorry.
Is,
what is it made of?
Of?
I did a D News about this years ago, and what I always thought was the coolest part is it's mostly like red blood cells and stuff like it's a lot of just, it's not all just food waste. Some of it is, okay, the body doesn't need this anymore, so we're going to excrete that. And it's like red blood cells that were, retired, so to speak. And so they've been replaced. Obviously liquid we didn't need.
Right. Okay. You're on
stuff
a pretty
we couldn't
good...
digest. Gum, if you swallowed it seven years ago.
Ooh, gross.
You know, stuff like that.
Myth. But anyway, you're right. Yeah, you've got, I'll say like bits and pieces floating around in there that are correct.
Okay, so that would be a Bristol stool chart number 3.
So the majority of the mass of poo is liquid. It's water, right? It's about 75% of poo is just water. So now of the dry mass of your stool, actually a ton of that is bacteria. Anywhere from a quarter to 54% of stool is bacteria, and it's either dead bacteria or still alive bacteria. And this makes sense because your large intestine, when you eat, right, and after it goes through your stomach and gets broken down and whatnot, and then it goes into your small intestine is actually absorbing the nutrients out of your food. And then once it goes through that big, long, you know, tunnel and gets to your large intestine, that's kind of like the afterburner of your body, right? Like the stuff that your body couldn't break down goes into your colon, and this area has a lot of bacteria, and these bacteria can break this unused food down, and the bacteria byproducts we can then break down into energy. So it's kind of like a little assist from the bacteria right at the end there, right?
Thanks, bacteria.
Thanks, bacteria, buds. So your colon, your large intestine, has a lot of bacteria that's just there to break down more stuff. And so, of course, this bacteria is going to multiply and die and also get swept up in the whole, you know, like things moving through the channel process. And so that's why they make up a quarter to more than half of your poo.
So it's not even your poop. It's just some bacteria poop.
A lot of it's dead, or more accurately, bacteria corpses. Right, just like a lot of dead bacteria biomass and a lot of living.
You think there's like a bacteria in the toilet that's just like, oh God. God, no!
Getting separated from its family.
Like, yeah,
it's I'll find you. And then it travels through the wastewater treatment system. That would be like a weird Pixar movie.
You know what? They've had... Everything else has had feelings.
Why not?
Why not bacteria? Feelings have had feelings in those movies. Come on.
Yeah, exactly. So, and then the rest is stuff that you couldn't break down, and fats and oils, stuff like that. And you're right about retired red blood cells. That brown color, stercobilin, is from broken down red blood cells and bile, and that's kind of what gives it poop its color.
That's interesting. I was also thinking, like, it does make sense when you said bacteria. That was one of the things I was going to mention, but I wasn't, like, if I had been asked, but I was not thinking it would be anywhere near as much as
right?
you said.
Definitely.
But it kind of makes sense, because if you think about it, like, fecal transplants, right? Like, really, it's to get microbes and reintroduce microbes into someone else's gut. And so, like, if there's wasn't a lot of bacteria or live microbes, like, why would we bother with feces?
That's right. You know? That's right. And like I said, they are kind of like a middle microbe to more energy for you from your food. So they're useful. They're helping us out, and we need them.
Fun sidebar: I was once in the room for a fecal transplant.
Wow.
How did that? Did you wander in, or were you invited? How?
I was invited. His name was Ryan, and he needed some help with his gut, and so they gave him a fecal transplant, and he was like, yeah, you can stay. And the doctor who was doing it was like, yeah, he signed the paper, you can stay in the room. So I was there the whole time. He was like, it was really, really interesting, and there's a camera on the end of the, you know, scope, and he's all the way up in his small intestine just, like, dropping liquefied poop inside of this other person's body. It was wild.
If there's a fecal donation program, do you think they call it, like, take a crap, give a crap?
I really hope so. Did you know the fecal transplant donation program? We talked to a donor for this piece as well. And they're in Boston, this company or nonprofit or whatever. And they're like, it's harder to get into this program than it is to get into Harvard. Because you have to, like, have never had antibiotics ever.
What?
Because it messes with your gut microbiome. So they're like, there's a huge questionnaire you have to fill out. And if you meet all of these, then you have to, even if you get in because of your gut microflora, you then have to poop at roughly the same time every day, because you have to do it near their offices. Like, they have a bathroom that you can, they let you go to the office, you knock on the door, they give you a tray, like a bowl. You go put the bowl in the toilet, you poop in the bowl, and then you bring it back to the office so that they can process the actual poop that you just pooped out. So you have to, like, drive to their offices every day. They pay you for this, of course, but it's like, it was a wild story.
Wow. Yeah. These people are the real heroes. That's incredible.
Right?
That's a lot. Oh, they really give a crap.
They really do give a crap.
Okay, so now let's imagine dictator comes to power. They're very anti-feces for whatever reason. They say, that's it. No more pooping. The health complications for people, let's just say, it would be bad for the individuals who are no longer pooping.
Who would this dictator be? Would it be Vladimir Putin?
Vladimir no pooping. If you have, you know, prolonged constipation, if you're pooping, everybody's different. You know, but if you're in general pooping less than 2 times a week and you're still eating, you can actually start filling up that colon with poop, and you can get a condition called megacolon or even toxic megacolon,
which
is
my
new favorite insult for people on the freeway in L.A.
Also, good band name.
That guy's a toxic megacolon.
Is that the lead singer of Toxic Megacolon?
Is that the lead singer? Yeah, where, you know, your colon, your large intestine just fills up with poop and grows and gets bigger. It can extend all the way up to your rib cage.
Ooh.
Yeah. Oh.
What?
Yes, something to think about. Yes. Ugh. And of course, with that comes the risk of it bursting.
Oh, my.
Yeah.
So it's...
Like, what's the timeline? Like, what's the timeline there? You know, if you just stopped, like, is it like a month before you could risk that?
That's a great question. A lot of the research I found about people not pooping actually has to do with children who, you know, they have like a painful experience, and they sort of get freaked out to poop. And
so they
just hold it. Yeah. And they can go, like, months without... Yeah.
Whoa.
Without poop. Months. Right. But I wouldn't recommend it. And there is the risk that, you know, your internals, like a big balloon, just swells up beyond any size that it was made to really handle. and then it could burst. And
yikes.
Yeah, and so there's a lot of medical complications, right? Obviously, around the rectum, you can get hemorrhoids where, you know, your veins are bulging out around your anus. You can get fecal impaction, so dry poop fills the rectum, and you can't push it out after that, so it makes future pooping worse, which is part of the problem these children have. Like, no, it just gets worse every time I go, so they are more, like, inclined to hold it. You can get rectal prolapse, where basically your butt falls out of your butt.
Your butt falls out of your butt?
Your butt falls out of your butt. Yeah, your rectum drops down and falls through the anus. Oof. And then you can also have urinary and bowel incontinence from weak pelvic floor muscles. It's bad. If you don't eat, you can go a long time possibly without pooping. There was a Live Science article about a British man who, right before being arrested, swallowed a bag of drugs, they suspect. And so the cops were just waiting for him to poop it out. And so he, in turn, was just not eating so he wouldn't have to poop. And he had gone over a month. But a problem might be malnutrition. And you can do, like, liquid feeding, basically, but it's difficult to do long term. So if everybody stopped pooping, maybe we could switch to, like, liquid nutrition, but it's not ideal. So let's assume that there's a magical reason why we don't need to poop. So, like, you know, we don't all swell up full of poop and stuff. So let's imagine what the world looked like if just magically, like, this dictator also had a wand that was like, no more poop, and then ring, like, nobody had the need to poop anymore. It was just whisked away from us somehow. First of all, you might be surprised how much you didn't have to poop anymore. Does anybody want to take a guess at how much poop the average adult makes annually?
Oh, wow. Sam,
like in pounds?
I will accept pounds or kilograms.
50. That seems
I was going to say like 200.
Ooh.
Let's do some math. Hang on. Wait, okay. Before you tell us, let's work together, Sam.
Okay.
We're talking two poops a week. Then we're talking 52 weeks a year without taking a break. Let's assume you didn't have a constipated
week. Let's say three poops a week.
I feel like two is pretty low.
Two seems low.
I was thinking like 4 to 5.
Yeah. Okay.
If you're two or fewer, you might be constipated. So let's assume three to more.
I was even thinking, like, what if it was, like, I think a lot of people can poop, like,
every day,
like one
I poop
a day.
Every day.
You know?
I'm an everyday guy.
Yeah. So, like, let's say you get
a pound of poop,
like,
a day, 365 pounds of poop.
Right.
But half, like, a pound a day.
I feel like a pound is a lot.
I remember once reading that you can lose up to 2 pounds just from excreting waste. Because they were like, if you're going to weigh yourself after you go to the bathroom for this, like, for something or other. I can't remember why I read that.
Interesting. Okay. But, so maybe it is like 300 something pounds a year. I was thinking it was more in like the
250.
Hundreds.
Yeah.
Low
yeah.
end hundreds.
Yeah. Your math has led you in the right direction. Apparently, an average adult flushes about 320 pounds of feces down the toilet each year, or 145 kilograms for our non-Freedom Unit listeners. That's more than I thought, frankly.
So 320 divided by 365 is 0.87, 0.88 pounds of poop a day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That sounds about right to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. That's a lot.
That's a lot of poop,
that
which
is.
Means, assuming, you know, a man lives to the average age of 76, that's about 24,320 pounds of poop in a lifetime, or 11,030 kilograms.
Wow.
That's a lot of poop.
That's a lot.
That is a lot.
Yeah. And women who get to live longer, about 25,920 pounds. So good way to go, ladies.
Good for us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. You're number one in number two. Okay.
Wait, hang on. So I use this website called The Measure of Things to give me good explanations of what those things are. Like, how much is a bathtub? And it'll say, like, that's about this or about that. 0.88 pounds is about as heavy as an American football.
Okay.
Or about as heavy as a soccer ball, like a football.
So both footballs.
Yeah. Or about as heavy as a can of soup.
Okay.
So that's the weight you're losing when you,
when you go to the can. Got it. Got it.
Good one, Julian.
Thank you. Okay. So that's a lot.
It is a lot.
And as you can imagine, you know, humans live in large clusters sometimes of hundreds of thousands to millions of us all in one place. So we have to do something with it. So if you live in a developed country, right, it goes through sewage treatment process. First thing that they might do is treat the wastewater with ferric sulfate. Goal is to remove phosphorus because phosphorus is great for plant and algae growth. So if this wastewater were to go straight into rivers, streams, water sources, you might get this algal bloom. And then when the algae dies, as it's decomposing, that process uses up a lot of oxygen. And then everything in there that needs oxygen, you know, like fish, that all suffocates underwater, which is a bummer.
Yeah.
So we treat it that way. And then they take it to settlement tanks, right? And they let the solid waste sink to the bottom and they call it sludge, which is gross. And the oils and fats and stuff that were also in the waste that they bubble up to the top, and that's scum. Another super gross name. And so
sludge, scum, like these are just the words themselves, like you feel a little bit icky.
Yeah.
Listen, I was walking my dog and I happened to meet a guy who works at the LA sewage treatment plant, and that guy was the most direct person I've ever spoken to. He's like, yeah, I work at the plant. Oh, we're gonna have to bleep that.
That's
and
fine.
I respect it. All right.
Yeah.
Those people have no bones about what they're doing. They're not like us over here clutching our pearls and like, ooh, poo-poo. They're like, people take dumps and we deal with it. You're welcome.
Yeah. And I mean, and we are grateful.
Yes.
Yes.
We should
we are.
Be.
We
should be.
We would be up creek
without
them.
No.
The show, the television show.
The shit. Yeah. No,
we would
to
all
that
have
one.
To sit at home, not pooping, watching Schitt's Creek.
I will take that punishment, actually. It's a great show.
It is a great show.
Okay. So, yeah, you've got your sludge at the bottom. You got your scum at the top. They use basically aeration with the sludge, right? They'll put it in treatment tanks, and they'll bubble up air through this wastewater to have a very oxygen-rich environment because they're trying to encourage aerobic bacteria to break down this sludge. And goes through further treatment processes. The sludge will also go through anaerobic treatment where bacteria that doesn't use oxygen breaks it down, and that produces a lot of methane. So it gets broken down and broken down and broken down. The methane can be recaptured and burned for electricity, which is fun. The sludge itself can further be dried and formed into, ready for another gross term? Cake.
Oh, no.
Yeah, it seems
not a
nice
food product.
You think about it, and then it's cake. Gross. Yeah, so they form it into like solid bricks of cake. And then you can burn the cake for energy. You can use it for fertilizer. It has uses. And eventually, you know, the water that was separated will be treated with chlorine to kill harmful bacteria like E. coli, and then chlorine is removed and the water is released, you know, sludge-free, poopy-free into waters and streams, and it's, you know, safe for the environment and safe for us to be around, which is good because, as it turns out, a lot of people worldwide do not have access to safe toilets, sewage systems that do all this, nothing. The number of people worldwide without access to safe toilets is 3.5 billion people, according to the UN. It is a lot, right? So if you say, okay, no more pooping, what does that look like? Well, for about half of the world's population, the sewage treatment plants kind of become redundant. We don't get a little bit of electricity, but it's not a lot. Like for a population of about 500,000 that like a sewage treatment plant services, they can use the electricity from it for maybe about 1,000 households for the year. You know, not a ton of electricity, but something. Fertilizer, again, not a ton, but something useful. And hey, if we're all not pooping because we're not eating, maybe we don't need that anyway. I don't know.
Yeah.
But for that other half of that of the world population, though, not having to poop actually might be a very good thing. Because, Sam, as I'm sure you know, the things that go along with poop and the diseases that it causes are multitude and horrible. You know, the contaminated water is linked to the transmission of cholera, diarrhea, dysentery, hepatitis A, typhoid, polio. About 1 million people each year are estimated to die just from diarrhea as a result of unsafe drinking water.
Yikes.
So it's if we didn't have to poop, honestly,
like magically, like ba-doo, no pooping,
the world would probably be a better place for a lot of people. But we can't help it, right? We as humans, as we established in the beginning, you gotta poop. And we congregate in big groups and we gotta poop somewhere. A lot of people end up going, you know, near sources of water, and it causes all these issues because it doesn't go through all these processes to clean it. So the UN has World Toilet Day on November the 19th. Mark your calendars.
Oh.
And it's to, and they have, there's no one individual UN program that deals with treating water. There's a lot of different ones, but the goal of World Toilet Day and the UN is to get everybody who needs it toilets and sanitation by 2030, which is a lot. It's a big ask. But their mascot is a hummingbird, apparently, after a mythical story of a hummingbird that would help with a fire by carrying drops of water in its beak to contribute in that way. So that's how they want people to think of it. Like, if you can help even a little bit somebody getting clean water and sanitation, like, you are doing an important part for the world. And I thought that was lovely. Mm. So, yeah. Sam, does that answer your question?
It does. Thank you. I thought that was great.
Thanks.
Nice.
Yeah, I thought it was a nice way to kind of think about, like, how important sanitation is and how many people don't have it.
Right.
Which was a shocking number. I couldn't believe 3.5 billion people.
Yeah, I didn't realize, now I feel, you know, very ignorant, of course, but, like, I didn't realize it was almost half of the world's population. Like, if you had asked me before, I would have said probably, like, 20%.
Mm-hmm.
No idea that it was closer to 50.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Me either. Yeah, there's still 400 million people, apparently, that just, they don't even have any sort of, like, toilet, sewage containment, whatever. It's just, like, out in the open. They have no other means of using the bathroom. So,
Whoa. Yeah,
it's a lot. It's a surprisingly huge amount of people. And it speaks to just kind of the risks and you know, how far we have to go.
Yeah.
So unless actually that horrible dictator is apparently doing everybody a solid. Oh, shoot. I did not mean to make that pun. So with that, we are going to take a break. And when we come back, Sam will share with us her answer. And welcome back to That's Absurd. Please elaborate. I hope you all had a nice bathroom break, and we're appreciative of what you have.
You've made cake.
Yeah. I'm going to go make some cake real quick. Ah, gross.
Is it layered? Are we talking sheet?
I can't believe it.
You know,
definitely sheet cake.
I guess it's
cake.
Sheet.
Gross. Well, Sam, I sure hope you don't have anything gross to share with us for your question.
Funny you mentioned that.
Yeah.
So my question comes from listener Danielle in New York.
Hello, absurd team. What is the filthiest, most absolutely disgusting animal? It can be of all time. It can be today's most gross animal. The only limitation that I can think of is by human standards. So, you know, your classic poop, puke, whatever it may be, revolting scenario. Thank you so much for this amazing opportunity.
Oh, good. Is it us based on my last answer? No spoilers. Don't tell me if I'm right. Don't tell me if I'm right.
It's funny that you say that, actually, because before I tell you my pick, I will say that I do think many could argue that humans are the most disgusting animal. So as a species, we travel the world catching and spreading disease both to other humans and other animals. We pollute the land, water, and air with waste, some of it being toxic. And many ecologists are saying that we are in the midst of the sixth mass extinction because species are vanishing so rapidly. You know, currently it's estimated that about 1 million species are on the brink of extinction. Yeah.
Cool.
Is that from our agriculture and hunting, or is that mostly because we're so disgusting? Like, what's the breakdown on that?
I think it's just, like, it's a lot of things, right? Mm. Like, a lot of them are human, you know, like, human-induced climate change related. Some of it is like toxic waste or just like using up resources that then animals no longer have access to. We really do a lot, you know, like we're terrible.
We're just Swiss Army knife of destruction.
No, we're not good for the earth. So, but I personally still don't find us to be the filthiest and most disgusting. I think, you know, I'm a bit biased as a human. I think we're just the most deplorable is really what I'm saying.
Interesting.
Okay, that's not better, but still I feel better about it.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, so long as I smell nice,
yeah.
Call me what you want.
Yeah. Okay, so here's where I'm going with this. There are so many animals out there that poop and urinate on themselves or each other, that will worm around in flesh, that will feed on dead, decaying things. So as I was researching this, it became clear that figuring out what the filthiest, most disgusting animal is really just kind of a pick your poison situation. Like, this is very subjective, but...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so... But I think I came up with a good one.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
All right, so now, with all of that as context, I'm going to tell you my pick. But I'm wondering, do you think that I chose an animal that lives on land or in the ocean?
Oh. Ooh.
See, okay. In my head, okay, here's what in my head, living in the ocean, you're cleaner because you're always in the water. So you're just like, I don't know. I'm going to tell you, I think I've said this on the podcast before. I don't like biology that much because it's so gross. Because everything's so gross and I have a good sense, like a strong sense of smell. So like, I don't like things that smell bad. And I don't like things that are sticky or gooey and like, you know, everything in nature is like that. So I always think of space is very clean.
Okay. Yeah.
There's no smell.
So it's really funny that you say that because like that's part of what I love about biology. And I also have like a very intense sense of smell. Like my husband gives me a very hard time for it because everything I'll walk around and be like, that's disgusting.
That smells.
That's disgusting. Yeah. That's just, you know.
I do the same thing.
Like, we do that in our house. My wife is always like, oh my God. And I'm like, I smell nothing.
It's just you, Julian.
Maybe it is me at this point. Like, because she'll walk into the apartment and be like, ah, and like start gagging. And I'm like, it's fine.
Yeah, I mean, it's this thing where like I feel like there's almost nothing in the trash, but if there's like a sliver of onion that was put in there the night before just like as waste, I will walk in and I will be like 30 feet away from it and be like, what is in the trash? Can you take out the trash? I can't even open it.
Anyhow. Exactly same in our household. We all married the wrong partners is what I'm hearing,
apparently.
So Sam, I'll take your husband. Trace, you get Katie.
Got it. And Sam, you can hang out with Flavia. She's cool.
She's super nice. Her birthday's coming up.
It is. So that's why I picked the ocean, because also I think of the ocean as somehow cleaner, because you're underwater, you're usually in motion, there's things happening, so even if you did poop, it would be washed away. So I would say on land.
I think your deduction is logical, and I think the fact that you even posed the question means it's a trick, so I'm going to say ocean.
You're proud.
Dang it.
It is indeed land.
Dang it.
Oh, gotcha.
I'm so suspicious of trick questions. I'm never right.
Did you have like just a teacher who they would throw one trick question on a test and you're like, never got over it?
Yeah. No, I'm just, I feel like the smartest people are always on to trick questions. So I'm just waiting for that chance to be like, aha.
I am also a smart person.
Can't pull the wool over my eyes.
Okay, so now that we know it's land and that it was not, I don't even know if I would say, so it was not a trick question. It is land. But now I want to know if you think I chose a mammal, a bird, reptile, amphibian, or insect.
Insect. Mm.
Do you have a thing against insects?
No, I have a theory on what it might be.
Ooh. I mean, mammals are pretty gross. Reptiles seem cleaner. I don't know why. I'm going to go mammal.
Okay. It's a bird.
Oh!
It's a bird! It's a bird?
Dang it. 0-2.
What?
That's a reptile.
Modern dinosaurs.
That's a reptile.
All right. So my choice is a bird, and it is the turkey vulture.
Oh, okay.
Turkey vulture.
That's a solid choice.
Have you guys seen turkey vultures?
I have seen them.
It's ringing a bell. I don't remember what would make them so disgusting that they'd take like the number one spot in the Sam Jones pantheon of disgusting creatures.
They don't look that gross. I'm looking at their Wikipedia page.
Right.
They don't look that gross.
Yeah. So, you know, like their coloration is... Weird. Not so shockingly, very similar to a turkey's. They have this like reddish pink featherless head, brownish black feathers. They're about 2.5 feet tall, 6-foot-ish wingspan. They only weigh a few pounds. Birds are generally quite light, right? Like gotta get up there and fly.
Makes sense.
So and they're actually found in tons of environments across North, Central, and South America.
Cool.
So they are. You'll see them in California. They also in the Mid-Atlantic. So I'm in DC. I saw turkey vultures relatively recently, actually. Oh, cool. Swarming a dumpster. So that was cool.
Oh,
okay. Disgusting.
Their natural prey.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. So I will say that turkey vultures, they have a lot of overlap with other vulture species in terms of being disgusting, but they seem to be better documented than most. And so I felt like I could just like bring more to our conversation with turkey vultures specifically. Mm-hmm. And plus, I thought this was pretty fun. There is this account of Charles Darwin seeing a turkey vulture when he was on the ship the Beagle in 1835, which was the trip that inspired his best known work on the Origin of Species. And so in seeing a turkey vulture from the deck of the ship, he called it a, quote, disgusting bird, unquote, whose bald head was, quote, formed to wallow in putridity.
Ooh.
Unquote, which is like, I've, you know, you hear the word putrid, but like putridity just has like such a,
yeah,
I don't know, it has like such a oomph to it.
Putridity. Yeah.
They don't write like they used to in the 1830s. Yeah. I tell you, yeah, what.
Did they open for maximum, what was it? Maximum expanded
toxic
colon?
Toxic megacolon.
Toxic megacolon? Yeah. Oh, putridity. Oh. They're opening for toxic megacolon. What a show that would be.
Yeah, so let's talk about what makes these birds so,
why are they so gross,
filthy and disgusting. Mm. So first off, I don't think this first fact makes them disgusting, but it's important context. So first off, turkey vultures, they have massive nostrils. So if you look in one side, you can actually see out the other.
What?
And they're super sensitive to smell. Oh. So some of what I've read has actually pegged turkey vultures as having the best sense of smell of any bird, which does distinguish them from other vulture species.
Hmm.
I couldn't find that in a ton of places, so I want to put a little asterisk on it, but yeah, it seems like they're really sensitive to smell. And so I'm wondering, what smell do you think they're trying to detect?
I mean, I'm assuming putridity.
I think it would be an onion left in a trash can the night before. Right?
But then it would
they're
mean
coming,
that Sam and the
Sam,
turkey vulture
for your
have a similar sense of smell.
You have to tell your husband, we can't, the vultures, the turkey vultures are coming.
They're circling. They're circling.
I saw them in D.C. They found they're on the hunt.
The smell they're trying to detect is death.
Yeah.
So, you know, like other vultures, they are carrion feeders. So that's C-A-R-R-I-O-N.
Oh, not like the baggage?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
So carrion is rotting flesh. The other Merriam-Webster definition for it, which I thought was kind of funny to read in this context, is, quote, flesh unfit for food. But I guess really it just depends on who you ask.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, true.
Yeah.
A couple of my vegan friends would be like, oh, so all.
All fine. Yeah.
So turkey vultures, they smell this rotting meat, pretty rotting dead stuff, pretty early in the process of decay. And so other vulture species like condors, for example, actually follow them to the carcasses. So I feel like they're kind of like leading the charge in
That's
terms
cool.
of grossness a little bit.
Yeah.
And then just a kind of cool little factoid. This isn't gross, just neat. I had no idea, but apparently in the 1950s, scientists were really trying to figure out if vultures detect dead decaying stuff by sight or by smell. Mm-hmm. And the story goes that a Union Oil Company employee told at least one of the scientists, one of these scientists, that vultures would congregate at the spots along gas pipelines where there were leaks.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that this key odor compound in decaying stuff is ethyl mercaptan, which is the exact compound that companies will add to odorless natural gas so that people can smell if there's a leak. So
that like rotting egg smell thing, right?
Yeah, it's like this like sulfury, right? Like kind of, yeah, it's pretty gross. It's pretty gross smell.
That's really neat. Like that they could use these turkey vultures to, one, find leaks, but also that would show exactly what they're trying to find. Are they looking for it or smelling it? And they're like, well, there's no dead thing here. There's just a smell.
I can't imagine the disappointment on the turkey vulture's face when like they like, oh, sweet dinner, and then it's just like,
yeah,
this
they're
pipe.
Like, where is it?
Yeah.
Like,
do birds drool
in the
I'm
pipe?
Just picturing them like in a cartoon being like, ah,
like flying toward it, just like so amped up, and then they're like, what? So Trace, you're right. Like this scientist, one of the scientists involved, I think the main scientist involved, his name was Kenneth Stager, and he was a curator of ornithology at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County. And so what he did was he deployed a mercaptan emitting machine in the field and was able to prove that vultures do, in fact, find their prey because of its smell.
Cool.
So anyway, that was a bit of a tangent. I thought it was fascinating. So let's really dive into the gross stuff now.
Okay.
Yeah.
Starting with their bald heads. So, any
rude,
guesses?
Rude to the balding audience that I'm sure we have.
Well, I hope that our balding audience is not doing any of what I'm about to explain.
Okay.
So, any guesses as to why researchers think that they have featherless heads?
Yeah, you got to stick your whole head inside a carcass there. Got to get on in there to get all the good stuff. You don't want it all stuck in your feathers. So
then it could have bacteria on it, so you don't want to get the bacteria in your feathers and get an infection.
See, if you are follicularly challenged, but bonuses here, right?
Yeah. Stick your head inside of a really disgusting thing, and you'd be less likely to...
You're in better shape. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
You're optimized for that.
That's true. So, yeah, you guys are right. It's really to keep themselves clean when eating. But you will remember that Darwin said their bald head was, quote, formed to wallow in putridity. And that's exactly what it is. So when vultures find a carcass, it might not be so decomposed already that the skin is still intact. And so, like, they need to find a way to get inside of it. So they're going to look for places of damage or holes that are already there, like the eyes or possibly anus.
So talk about cake.
Yes. Not just coming into contact with flesh, I guess, is what we will say. They will put their whole head in there. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah,
okay,
and
cool.
So, yeah, and right, like they can't reach their head and neck when they're preening, which is like when birds clean their feathers with their beaks. So I guess like this is one point for evolution helping these birds be like a little bit more sanitary because I can't imagine, but I don't want to imagine if they were doing
that. I don't
that.
Like it.
With feathers all over their heads. Okay, and so then an analysis of DNA taken from the turkey vultures' heads showed remnants of raccoon, cow, rabbit, coyote, bunch of other animals. Really, they will eat any dead thing. Of course, people. They didn't mention human DNA, but like they will eat anything that is dead.
I'd be worried if they've... That means that there's a body out there somewhere that these vultures had found.
Right. That's a great point. But like, I'm sure this is also then another tangent, but I'm sure like sometimes there are vultures that show up on like anthropological research facilities, like body farms where they like that's part of the research is to see like how human bodies decompose under different conditions.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like I read something once that said that they like specifically had to put like coverings over certain areas to avoid vultures.
I've done some stories on body farms and stuff over the years, and they put them in like cages so that animals can't get into them, but that the air can still get to them because they want them to be able to like decompose properly.
Yeah.
Morbid.
It's pretty wild. It's like cages of dead bodies in a field.
Yeah.
They just go check
on
them.
No, it's pretty fascinating. We did a Tiny Matters on body farms as well. I just can't remember if vultures were specifically mentioned, but anyhow.
Cool.
These birds will eat anything, and they can in part because their digestive systems are incredibly acidic. So turkey vulture stomach acid has a pH of just above zero, which is a lower pH than car battery acid. And it's also 100 times as concentrated as the gastric juice in our stomachs.
I was going to say.
Which is like very acidic.
Yeah, we're like a pH of 2, and pH is logarithmic, so zero would be 10 to the 2, about 100 times.
Yeah.
More powerful. That's bananas.
Yeah. And so this unbelievably acidic environment will obliterate many bacteria and other microbes that could be dangerous in the food that they're eating. But still, their guts are filled with bacteria that are known to cause severe food poisoning and even death in humans.
Oh, I bet.
So they seem to have developed a tolerance for bacteria that cause things like botulism.
Where,
like, with botulism, you have this bacteria that can produce a toxin that will actually attack your nerves.
Yeah. Or tighten up your face and make you beautiful.
Yes. Yeah.
One or the other.
Botulinum toxin. That is Botox.
That's Botox, baby.
Yes. And so studies have also shown that they harbor bacteria that typically cause gangrene and tetanus.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But they seem to be fine, just like having these in their gut.
Just
and there is some
life.
Evidence that the bacteria might even help them with some of their digestion, which is wild.
Do you know how they basically don't digest their own stomachs? Like what adaptation do they need for that, that low of a pH?
That is a great question. I'm sure they have, like, I'm sure it has to do with some sort of like mucosal membrane,
like
on their skin
super
cells.
Mucus,
working
though.
Overtime.
Like,
yeah. Just
how much mucus do they make? Like, is it constantly being regenerated? Oh, man. That's so
interesting. It's a great question because, like, how do any cells survive with that? Right.
That is such a wild pH. Oh, my God.
Yeah. Moving on to some other important details. Turkey vultures also poop and pee on their own legs to keep cool.
Oh, like you do.
So, Yeah. So doing this helps them lower their body temperature because as the excrement evaporates off their skin, that cools the blood vessels that are in their legs.
Yeah, same.
Yeah. And to be fair, like, they are not the only birds that do this. Like, a number of birds will do that, but it's still pretty filthy.
Right. Oh, yeah, definitely. Right. I mean, it, logically, sure. Yes, totally makes sense. But man, oh, man.
Yeah.
So these are all the reasons that the turkey takes top spot, huh?
I'm not done.
Yeah. Oh, God. There's worse? There's better? Yes.
There's a little more for you.
You know what, Sam? At the start of this, I said, I find biology disgusting and oozy and stinky and gross and smells bad. Maybe I should have kept that to myself.
Yeah. Yeah. I liked biology at the start of this. I'm having second thoughts.
So this, like, urine excrement mixture also seems to help kill off bacteria and parasites that get on their legs and feet due to their pretty, I guess we could say, like, intense eating habits, if you want to call it that.
Intense. I
don't know if that makes it more gross, but I just thought that was kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. All right. So I have one more thing. But just to recap first, these birds, they're finely tuned to detect dead stuff. They will stick their heads up a dead animal's anus or through its eyes to get at the meat. Mm. They have stomachs that are more corrosive than battery acid, that are filled with deadly bacteria, and they poop and pee on themselves.
Wow.
Great. So one more thing. When turkey vultures feel threatened by a potential predator, they will vomit.
I knew you were going to say that!
Oh, God! No!
And they're typically vomiting up rancid meat.
Oh, and acid too, right?
Yes, exactly. Oh, no. Exactly. Smells really bad, makes them less appealing to predators. And also remember, right, super acidic gastric juices. So yeah, you can add corrosive vomit to the list of why I think these are the filthiest, most disgusting animals. But the last thing that I will say in defense of these birds is that they are very important for ecosystems. So removing dead, decomposing animals from the environment means not just having, like, fewer nasty, rotting things around, but it also means fewer breeding grounds for disease. So although these animals are disgusting, think of how disgusting our world might be without them.
Oh, good wrap up.
Nice. You really turn it around there at the end.
Oh, my God. That's exactly what one turkey vulture would say to the other when it was hungry. You really turned it around there at the end to put your head up the anus.
The anus, right. I'm just glad. You remember that Alfred Hitchcock movie, The Birds?
Oh, God.
And it was just birds attacking people. Not very imaginative. I'm imagining fleets of turkey vultures bombing, like vomit bombing across cities, frankly.
Yeah.
I think we need a remake. I think we need a new
imagining that, but now
Birdemic movie.
Yes. Oh.
Can I tell you I thought it was going to be? Because I learned recently
I would
about
love to
a
know.
Little... A little creature that I thought was quite disgusting. Apparently, some leaf beetles in their larval stage, right, in order to protect themselves, they make a little shield, right? And they make this little shield out of poop.
Mm.
They poop in such a way that it, like, curls over them and hardens and forms, seriously, like a protective layer of feces over the larva. And I was like, that's... pretty disgusting. That's up there for me. Turkey vulture, I think, takes the cake, but not
good pun.
But I thought I learned about that little guy recently, and I was like, that's got to be in the conversation, right? That's pretty gross. No, I think turkey vulture wins it.
So there's a lot of ones that are just like very poop related. You have the dung beetle.
Yeah, classic. Love a dung beetle. They're
right,
so cool.
Like, right, they use poop for so many things. Like, they will mate in poop. They will, like, roll it into this massive ball. They will, like, there's
no kink
all this...
shaming on this podcast. You do whatever you got to do.
But yeah, like, turkey vulture was just like, it hit so many disgusting points that I felt like it was a good fit.
The vomit was just, that was the over the top.
That's the kicker.
That was just like, oh my gosh.
Uh-huh.
Jeez.
Uh-huh. Pretty gross, Sam. Pretty gross.
Thank you. Thank you for bringing that to us. And Danielle, thank you for asking that horrible question.
Yes, thank you.
Oh, my God. Okay.
I had a lot of fun researching that.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
Let's take a quick break and come back for my question.
Welcome back to That's Absurd, Please Elaborate. I'm going to throw it over to Trace, who has another question from a listener.
Trace, is it disgusting? Is it gross? Is it horrible?
I'm going to tell you now, it is not disgusting. It is not gross, and hopefully it is not horrible. So we get a little reprieve here at the end of this very disgusting episode. This comes from a listener, Mallory in Michigan, and she did send us an audio clip.
Hi, Trace. Hi, Julian. It's Mallory from Michigan. I have a question for the pod. What's the best way to potato? Baxter Ale's at brunch with some friends, and this question came over me. There are so many options. Like they can be fried, they can be roasted, mashed, they can be cut into cubes, they can be shoestrings, curly, waffle, hash browns, crinkle chip. I mean, just, there's so many options. What's the best? Thanks, guys. Love the show.
The potato passion is there.
It is.
She clearly likes chips. I feel like that was, she forgot it existed. Like, then she remembered
chips.
It existed. And she was so excited.
Wow, I'm done a 180. I was so grossed out not 30 seconds ago. And now I'm like, oh man, potatoes. Mallory's got
a point.
Like,
I could eat some fries right now.
Yeah, right. I feel like this is going to be the weirdest episode for our emotions here. We're going to get poop, disgust. And then at the end of this, I think everybody's going to be pretty hungry. This episode, we're recording it in February, but it's going to air close to when I think this might be our 1 year eve for our episode release. So in a 1 year, I do think we found the most absurd question, which is, what is the best way to potato? With
potato.
No further context until she said, does the audio. Firstly, I'd love your opinions if you have best way to potato.
Yeah, that's the thing that I'm hung up on, right, is the way it's asked of the best way to potato. Like, potato is a verb.
Interesting.
I'm trying to imagine how one would potato.
My first thought was modified potato starch, which is used in a lot of different chemical processes, similar to what we did to corn, where we like took it and made it into component parts. But I ended up going in a different direction. But that was what I first thought of.
I was picturing burying yourself in a field somewhere and then just like waiting to be pulled up by a farmer. That's like if you were to potato.
I was thinking like couch potato. So I was thinking like, the best way to potato would be like create like a really comfy like blanket fort setup, maybe even eat French fries or some other form of potato. So you can be like a potato eating potatoes.
That's nice. I love that. Is potato a verb like buffalo? I didn't even look. I should look. Well, I looked at potato as what it is, as the potato. And the reason I did, I think you'll come with me on, is because a potato is probably one of the most important crops humans have. Like, at the end of this, I want you to think of potatoes on par with stuff that we think of as staple foods like rice and pasta. Potato is right there alongside those two. And so once I learned that, I'm like, well, we got to talk about the potato. Mm-hmm. I just had,
if you were on the couch in a blanket fort eating potatoes, would you say you'd released your inner tuber?
Oh, God. I would feel like that would happen if I were on a river, floating down the river eating potatoes. Then I would be an inner tuber.
This is a very stream of conscious question, which Meredith, clearly it was the same for her too. So
yeah.
Okay, but actual dealing with the staple crop. Tell us about that.
Okay, so the potato was the first vegetable grown in space. Fun fact. There was the book, The Potato, A History of the Propitious Esculent, by John Reeder, and this book came out in the late 1700s.
I was going to say,
and it said the potatoes could be bought on the streets of Paris, either raw or roasted like chestnuts, which is so interesting because the potato is not from Europe. We associate it with European cooking in things like gnocchis, and obviously Ireland has a lot of association with potatoes. But potatoes are a New World food. Shout out to an earlier episode where we talked about the Columbian expansion. French fries were probably introduced to the United States in the 1700s when Thomas Jefferson had dinner in France with the King of France, and Ben Franklin also attended a dinner in the King of France, served everything that was made of potatoes. Literally everything at the dinner was potatoes, which actually sounds kind of awesome. Like potato soups and potato, even the liquor was potatoes, which
that
is
sounds
so
like
really,
the best
really
way to
cool.
Potato.
Yeah.
You,
so I was
all
like,
all spuds and the King of France.
Like, that's right. Just hang out with the King of France and just eat everything potato, which just sounds awesome. But it's, again, native to the Americas. And so when the Europeans first showed up, one of the first things they saw was potatoes. They showed up in the Caribbean and the Taino people were eating this root vegetable that they called batata. That's today like Cuba, Dominican Republic, Jamaica, Haiti, Puerto Rico, Bahamas, like that region of the Caribbean. And the Europeans ate it and they were like, we're going to call this
patata, potato, because they were Spanish. And then it was sweeter than the potato that you're thinking of, though. It wasn't like the white, starchy potato that we eat now. Although starch is a sugar, it was a sweeter potato, more like a sweet potato, but we'll come back to that. So for several decades, the Europeans were exploring the Caribbean and Central America, and there were potatoes everywhere. So they were taking them back to Europe, being like, we should eat these. These are really cool. But eventually they got to South America, and in Peru and Chile and Bolivia, they found a completely different root vegetable that they called papa, which is a similar thing, and that is the potato that you're likely thinking of when you think of potato. Oh. So at first, they actually found something that we would think of as a sweet potato, and then they came up with the word for potato, and they brought it back to Europe, and they're like, cool, we got this potato thing. Then a few decades later, they met new people who also had a potato, and they're like, well, we can't call this a potato. So what do we call it? And in English, they called it the bastard potato.
Rude?
Yeah, or the Virginia potato, because it wasn't as sweet, and it was like bigger and lumpier and stuff. So that's where we get all these different words from potato. But anyway, the Central and South Americans were eating this food for so long, and they have documentation that it was a staple crop in the Americas for more than 10,000 years. And just in case you want some comparison, the Giza pyramids are like 4,000 to 5,000 years old. So like twice as long as there have been the Giza pyramids, they were eating potatoes in South America and Central America. So it was a really important staple crop for these, when we hear about these Central and South American populations that were huge, in part it was because they were able to grow this staple crop and like feed large populations. And now we can do that everywhere in the world because of the potato. So the Europeans take it home, and the Bon Appetit found an English sailor who wrote in 1565, "The most delicate roots that may be eaten and do far exceed are parsnips or carrots."
I'm sure that's exactly how sailors.
That was really good.
Probably more
seems
like, "Oh, delicate rope may be eat me for do you see the parsnip and the carrot."
Tell you what, it sure beats the heck out of parsnips and carrots, eh? It's easy to sink my free teeth into.
What you think, Aaron Aronson? You're going to bring us back to your pile of mud?
I buried these in my pile of mud, put a little sticks there, no number of potatoes in there. I'm going to change world cuisine. Me and King of France will be dining on these in 200 years.
We have a moderately recurring character named Aaron Aronson.
He's a British peasant. He owns a mud pile and three sticks.
That's right. When Julian calls me on the phone, an AI image of Aaron Aronson's mud pile is what appears. So
now you're caught up on the lore.
So
of that,
the lore of Aaron Aronson. Even historians, by the way, get confused as to which potato people are talking about, because not everybody used Virginia or bastard potato. They would just call it a potato. So eventually they dropped that and they ended up having sweet potato, which we think of today as sweet potato, and then potato. Now, yam is a slightly different root vegetable, but they're all in the same group. And the really interesting thing is when the Europeans showed up and they started eating the sweet potato, the batata, that was in the same family as the morning glory or the bindweed. And so it's the family of Convolvulaceae, and the species is Turbosum. Again, related to morning glories. But the other potato that we now eat a lot that isn't the sweet potato is in a completely different family. It's not even related to the first potato. It's these two root vegetables, these two tubers, but really only one's a tuber, were eaten in very close to each other in the world, but they were completely different, had evolved completely differently in this convergent evolution way, where they both had this like big, thick underground root vegetable that you could pull up and eat. The new potato, that the second potato they found, is in the family Solanaceae. It's a nightshade family. There's 2,700 different species, and that's the one we eat today. Also in that species are bell peppers, chilies, and eggplants. So these are the potatoes that we have. So
I'm just wondering, like, when you go to the grocery store and it's like golden potato, russet potato, all these things, like, are those species or are they just like variations? Like, we've just messed with this original potato, and like with dogs, like, right? Like, you know, I have these dogs that look very different from a lot of other dogs, but like they're all the same species.
Yeah. I think you're right that it's a variety. So it's just like we've bred these potatoes. We found them and we said, oh, this one's really good. We're just going to grow lots of that one.
Got it.
In Peru, they have something like 3,800 different varieties of potato in every different color combo. We usually only eat a couple of those in the U.S. Right. Like with a lot of our food systems, it comes to industrialized food systems can only grow things that can support industrialized growth. And so like we're not going to eat all these heirloom potatoes. We're only going to eat the russet, the red, the yellow, the white, the purple, the fingerling, and the petite, which are according to the Potatoes USA, the Agricultural Cooperative of Potato Farmers, the all seven right. different types of potatoes that cool. we consume. So the Caribbean potato is how I'm trying to talk about it so that we can kind of keep them separate in our head. So the Caribbean potato, people grow all over the world in warmer areas typically because it needs that. And then the Peruvian potato, the reason that it kind of took over is because it can grow at high altitudes, in cooler areas, in temperate climates, places like Russia, places like Ireland, places like Canada, you know, places that are away from the tropics, this potato grows very well. And I think that's really interesting. So the reason we associate it with Ireland is because it became a staple of the Irish diet by 1630. And the reason that that happened is because before that, think about what people would eat without potatoes, right? We're going to eat rice. Okay, it's going to be very complicated to grow it. It takes very specific like ways to grow. And then once it's harvested, we have to process it with grain, like with bread, which was the most common staple food in a lot of the world. You have to grow a grain, harvest it, process it, mill it, combine it with other ingredients, then bake it, and then you can serve it to eat. Whereas a potato, you grow it, pull it out of the ground, and cook it. That's it. Like, you're done. And so it's so much easier. It can become this incredible staple food. So really, this is where I kind of get to the best way to potato, right? When you eat a potato, we like three things if you have read the book or watched the show: salt, fat, acid, heat, right? We like salt, fat, and sugar. And potatoes are made of all of these things. They're high in calories and starch, which is a kind of sugar. And then they also have, you know, a variety of other vitamins: vitamin C, potassium, fiber. Sweet potatoes have vitamin A. Purple potatoes have more antioxidants in them. But potatoes in general are pretty darn good for you as long as you're not adding all that other stuff. When people are like, oh, don't eat too many potatoes, typically it's the stuff we put on them, you know, cheese and sour cream and lots of salt and all that other
chili
stuff. Chili. Yeah. That make them really, really good. But that's the stuff where they're like, oh, maybe don't eat too much. So sticking to the kind of cold weather or like the Peruvian potato, which now we grow everywhere. The best way to potato, firstly, is to cook it, right? You have to cook a potato.
Fair.
So first you cook. A raw potato can be eaten. I don't know if you've ever tried to bite into a raw potato. It kind of has an apple-y texture, but it doesn't taste very good. In a raw potato is something called resistant starch, which is a non-digestible starch. However, a lot of the health blogs tout the benefits of eating raw potatoes because they don't raise your blood sugar because they're not digestible. So you just eat it. And then you poop it out.
Styrofoam won't raise your blood sugar either,
yeah, exactly.
By that logic, right?
Right.
Like, yeah.
Okay. Sure.
However,
I'm rolling my eyes. I'm
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
In the audio.
Yeah.
I heard it. It was audible.
Yeah.
raw potatoes. The benefits of not getting the sugar that your body
right.
just eat a correct amount of sugar.
Yeah.
Anyway, go on.
So raw potatoes also contain glycoalkaloids like solanine, chaconine, and lectin, which are proteins and anti-nutrients. So not awesome. Solanine is mildly poisonous, causes gastric distress unless you eat a lot of it, in which case it can literally kill you. But that's if you like eat pounds or kilos of it. According to Brian Kwok-Lee, a PhD food scientist, very toxic levels of solanine can cause hallucinations, paralysis, loss of sensation, and death. So don't eat raw potatoes.
Yeah.
Although, again, the health blogs will say they have more vitamin C in them, the raw ones.
Truly, eat a Starburst. I don't know. That happens.
We just made a bunch of health blog readers go, the processed.
No. Go eat an orange.
Go eat an orange.
Don't eat raw potatoes.
No.
Go eat an orange.
What if
don't
I only orange. Have potatoes and I'm deciding whether or not to cook them? What if I'm in a very peculiar circumstance?
Then cook them. Just go cook them.
Please cook them.
Literally microwave them. That's fine. Poke it. Put it in the microwave for 10 minutes. You've got a potato.
Ah, so good.
When we cook stuff, the reason we also have to cook it is because it tastes better. You know, you get the Maillard reaction, the non-enzymatic browning reaction that is amazing and makes most of our foods delicious, including bread crusts, baked goods, dark beer, coffee, cocoa, shout out episode 23, and grilled meats. So potatoes also get that Maillard reaction. So the best way to potato, cook it, then add some salt and fat. It's also available, by the way. That wouldn't be the best way to potato, would be a potato you have. So since it's easy to grow, you can get it, which means like a loaded baked potato has like salt, has fat, it has some acid to it, it has all the calories, it has some vitamins.
It was cooked.
Yeah, it's cooked. Not everybody's favorite spud, but you know, it's pretty good. That would maybe be a contender for the best way to potato is just like bake it, because you're not frying it and adding a bunch of oil to it. But in the 1960s, Dr. Alina Cermaka Chesniak of General Foods Corporation created something called the texturometer for objective texture measurement of food products. It launched an entire classification and area of study called rheology. It's basically mouthfeel and texture, but it can be tested via a machine, and it can be objectively measured.
What's this machine called again? I'm going to look it up.
It's the texturometer. It looks kind of like a really fancy smushing machine is basically what it looks like. And it's still used today. The General Foods Corporation was purchased by a number of other corporations. Now I think it's owned by Kraft. Doesn't really matter. The TPA measure is still used, and it has 7 different ways to measure things. Hardness, which is peak force of compression. Fracturability, which is, you know, what it sounds like, things breaking at a certain pressure. Cohesiveness, which is, does something deform immediately or can it be smashed multiple times? Springiness, so does it return to its original height when smushed, which is really awesome. Then there's either semi-solid or solid foods can have gumminess, which is a calculation of hardness and cohesiveness, or chewiness, which is gumminess times springiness. And then there's resilience, which is a material that wants to return to its original height, which I think of as mochi, right?
But like
it really wants to come right
that
back.
That sounds like
completely different than springiness, apparently. So anyway, I'm honestly now obsessed with this idea that you can just put a potato chip or whatever. And there are numbers for each of this. So like tofu has like a negative score on cohesiveness because it just like comes apart immediately, but it's got and like a really low score on hardness, and it's just incredible. You can put any food into this system, like yogurt or jawbreakers or whatever, and they'll all come up with different scores on all of these.
I understand she maybe quantified like some qualities of food, but did they also say like these are the most desirable? Like did they test a bunch of people and be like, oh, people love a number 7 on the springiness scale.
Yes.
So when we make food, we got to shoot for 7 or something. Like they did. They did.
Yes.
That.
And that's why I bring it up, because the best way to potato could be objectively measured.
No.
Using the texturometer.
This science has gone too far. This is where I draw the line.
Unfortunately, because everybody is unique, right? Some people prefer like the crunch of that Cape Cod chip versus like the, if you think of like a Cape Cod chip, if you haven't had it, or like a kettle cooked,
yeah.
Right, a kettle cooked potato chip that's kind of folded over on itself is crunchy. That crunchiness would fit under a specific hardness, a specific fracturability, the cohesiveness of it, like can it take multiple chews or does it completely come apart on that first chew? The springiness, it's not going to be very springy, and its resilience, it's never going to return to its original height, but its chewiness of that like gumminess plus springiness could be really interesting to learn. And so they do this with the food that we eat all the time so that they can get the correct textures for the most amount of people to enjoy. A research scientist at USC named John Allen wrote a book, The Omnivorous Mind, Our Evolving Relationship with Food, and explores specifically why we love crunchy things. And we really love crunchy things. And there is like evidence dating back to ancient times that people liked crunchy things, because food with single consistencies, textures, colors, and flavors is really boring. We don't like that.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I try and add crunch to like everything that I eat.
Yeah.
How many times do I put chips in a sandwich?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Or even even with a baked potato, a little bit of bacon bits in there.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So if we want, and that adds a little bit of fat as well. So we chives. Get like the that best way to potato, you can add those things. So a crunch also adds a stimulation to you. Like you get stimulation for the tongue, the nerves in the head, the ears. You can hear it, you know, and all of those things add to the sensations of food, which when we think of food, we typically think of flavor and then often smell. But this texture component, which isn't super popular to talk about or think about in Western food, is very popular to think about an Asian food experience. Mm-hmm. We think of as like crunchy as basically the main texture. There are chefs who are have been quoted, I think Mario Batali maybe, now I can't remember, who they said if they put crispy in front of the dish that is on the menu, the number of orders will rise like a huge percentage. Just adding the term crispy to it. Because people love, they like see crispy and they're like, ooh, want it, deal.
Yeah. Crispy something tacos. Crispy. Yeah.
Like, right. Exactly.
Yeah. Extra just sounds crispy. Better.
Yeah. Like that. Right? Yeah. Yeah. So it also explains, by the way, why it's difficult to have mass quantities of food that satisfy all of these different things or satisfy, like hit the best, but also why the chip aisle is like entirely one type of food, right? That entire aisle at the grocery store is all of that. And part of that is because of this crunchiness that we spend a lot of time on. Mm. So the best way to cook a potato, or the best way to potato, is to cook it, then give it a pleasing texture, which you could get from Dr. Chesniak's texturometer, and give it a pleasing flavor, which involves salt and fat and some acid. And then, so that would mean maybe you have like a crumbly texture, like a hash brown, or you have a crispy texture, like a French fry, or that resilient texture, like a gnocchi, or a fracturable texture, like a potato chip. You could have a low cohesive score, like a mashed potato. And I think the best way to potato, I think, is all potato. Like all potatoes, the best way to potato.
Mm.
You cook it and you can do almost anything with it, which you can also do with other staple foods like pasta. Can be almost anything. Rice can be put in almost everything. And like any other foundational staple food, the potato, even though we don't think of it that way, we think of it as like this kind of fun side or this fun other piece, is just the best way. Is that, that's it, just potato.
I'll tell you the worst way to potato.
Ooh.
Yeah. Okay.
Is it eating them raw and dying of whatever it is?
Raw's good. Okay, I'll submit the second worst way to potato.
Is it the smiley tater tot ones?
Because
those
I
are really
submit
awful.
Reheated French fries are the second worst way to potato.
They're sad.
Okay, so I did research that.
Trace, why are reheated French fries the second worst way to potato, apparently?
This is the best question, and I did research this.
Yes.
So French fries are amazing, right?
Facts.
It fits with the best way to potato. It's hot. It's got a texture element that's really pleasing, an outside crunch with an inside fluff. Actually, they usually use russet potatoes for this, for that exact reason. That russet potato has a lot of starch in it, and it doesn't break down as much when it's cooked, I guess. It like keeps some of its texture, and it's really nice. The thing is, typically, when you make a French fry, you would slice it up and then you would soak it in water for a long time so that the water is absorbed into the potato. Then you would fry it. And then when you fry it, sometimes you would even double fry it. When you fry it, what ends up happening is the water gets kind of trapped in there and the outside gets all crispy. Right? Starch molecules actually was described in a book that I was reading for this episode. Are sort of think of them like a little balloon. And when that happens, the little balloon fills up with the water that has been absorbed by the potato. However, as it cools, the water leaks out of the starch molecule, and that makes the outside crispy texture kind of go wonky. So you end up with this like kind of wet thing, and you can't put the water back into the starch molecule. Even if you refry it, you just put oil into the starch molecule. If you bake it, then you're just dehydrating the entirety of the food product. So it's never as good, even reheated, as it was the first time, because you just can't get it back to that spot, which I think is awesome.
That makes a lot of sense.
That's why it's gross. And that's why you got to make sure your potatoes don't get cold once you've fried them. Because you can't get that water back into that starch molecule. Another fun aside, Planet Money did this incredible episode about the 1970 potato war. Mm-hmm. Do you know where most potatoes come from in the U.S., right?
Idaho,
right. That was not always the case. The main potato grower prior to the 1976 potato war was Maine.
What?
The state of Maine.
That is
It is
so
still
great,
Maine's
though.
Number one crop.
Wow.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
It's shocking.
It's potatoes, milk, and then eggs, 99% of U.S. blueberries, and of course, 90% of U.S. lobster. But otherwise, it's potatoes. Isn't that wild?
That is.
I would not have known that.
Yeah.
That is bananas.
Yeah.
Huh.
Can I read you perhaps the most surprising quote I've ever read on all my time on the internet? And I went and I verified that it is factual.
Yes.
Do you want to hear it? And it's French fry related. Ready?
Okay.
This is the quote. See if you can guess who said this. The McDonald's French fry is unbelievable. When you bite into it, you think it's so tasty, it can't be real. As soon as it gets cold, it turns to lard and flubble. I mean, have you ever tried to eat a McDonald's French fry that's gone cold? That's one of the circles of hell. The gulf between the warm, fresh, lightly salted McDonald's French fry and the cold McDonald's French fry is as great a gulf as any I know.
That's really good.
Do you want to know who said that? Viggo Mortensen in an interview with Esquire magazine.
Like, what prompted that answer?
No.
He'd had a rough day. He had a cut. Served. He went to the McDonald's on the way to the interview.
I remember reading that quote and seeing it's a tribute, and I was like, there's no way this is real. And I went and found it in Esquire, and it's true. And I'm like, what? It's like the most beautiful poetry about old French fries.
Incredible.
Yeah.
From Viggo Mortensen.
It's very good.
Oh my gosh, it's my favorite.
Okay. So DoorDash analyzed its data. What do you think is the number one ordered potato product on all of DoorDash?
Potato product?
Yeah. Like, there are different, you know, ways to order potatoes. We've sort of mentioned some: French fries, hash browns, potato chips, pasta, et cetera, et cetera.
Tater tots.
I was going to say tater tots. Yeah.
Tots are number six.
Oh, jeez. I just don't think fries hold up well to delivery for things Mortensen talked about.
I agree, but French fries are number one.
Yeah.
French fries are number one. Sense. Okay.
69% of all potato order is French fry.
People love fries.
And the thing is, like, fries can be so many things because there are certain types of fries I'm just not into. I'm just not. But if you give me, like, if you gave me a, any type of fry, waffle fry.
Yes!
100%.
So number one was French fry. Number two was hash brown. They broke waffle fry out of French fry, which I think is interesting because we're not going to break skinny fry from, like, fat fry or steak fry. So I find that to be, I was happy that it's in the top three. Mashed potato was number four. Potato salad was number five. And then tots. Then baked potatoes, potato skins, home fries, and then they also broke out loaded tater tots as a separate category, and that was like number 11 for some reason.
Doesn't feel very scientific.
Not
loaded fries then should be their own category.
Yeah, which is why I didn't include it, because I was just like, what data is this?
I also, honestly, like, I'm kind of shocked by this. Like, I'm not so shocked by potato salad. I'm more shocked by how high up hash browns are, because I feel like those don't travel well.
Yeah.
Like, they just don't. Like, they get kind of, like, those are, like, you got to get them, you got to eat them right when they come out. Like,
you really do.
Can't even sit for a second.
Yeah. I'm going to put you on the spot, though. What is your personal favorite way to potato?
Oh, my God.
I think we need a definitive answer more than just, like, they're all good. Because they are.
They're all good.
They're all beautiful.
The best way to potato is to potato. I mean, waffle fry is pretty incredible. It's hard to beat. Although, Steak and Shake at 3 in the morning has, right out of the fryer, if you've ever had a Steak and Shake fry, they're like, I don't know, like an eighth of an inch thick. So they're just super skinny. Like, it's like a shoestring fry, but they're not long. They're still like little teeny ones. You could eat them with a fork and just like scoop them. And it's at 3 in the morning at a Steak and Shake. Like, that's pretty good potato. And they're really salty.
I think I'd have to agree with you on that, because I was once in Europe traveling and there was a hot dog cart with those little fries you could put on top. And I was blackout drunk.
Yeah.
And I woke up with those in my pocket. So I must have really liked those.
Wow.
And I took a lot more and saved them for later. So I think I'm going to have to agree with the super skinny fry.
We just learned a lot about you, Julia. And me, too. Sam, when you said there are some potato that you don't like to potato, I want you to spill the tea. What don't you like?
Yeah, so, like, I'm not a huge fan of just, like, a standard baked potato. I think also my issue is I'm lactose intolerant, so I can't, like, slather a bunch of sour cream on it.
You can't put cheese and sour cream on it. Then why are you going to eat that? Yeah.
Exactly.
I get it.
Yeah. But I will say the other one that I think some people will take issue with are steak fries, like the really thick fries that are just very potato forward.
I'm totally with you. Yes.
Yeah.
I don't like steak fries. Okay. I don't like them at all. I think the ratio of fluffy inner potato to crispy outer potato is wrong in a steak fry. Clearly, if my favorite is super skinny, yes, very crispy, nice and hot, like I like the outer more than the fluffy inner.
You like that surface area.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Which is also why I think waffle fries are so good. You get more of that crispy surface area.
Oh, yeah.
And hash browns can be good, except for you have to go to the right spot, because if you get it and it's just like raw, not raw, it's obviously
cooked.
No,
but sometimes it's just not cooked enough on the top and bottom.
Yeah. You have to like really get it right.
Yeah.
Because I like that crispiness.
I can't believe after this episode, I'm going to be this hungry.
You're welcome.
I know. It is shocking. I'm like really craving some fries right now.
Well, part of that is evolution, and part of that is just, it's just potato. That's all I got.
I hope that answered Mallory's question.
Yeah, I hope so too. Mallory's actually a friend of mine, so I'm gonna tell her that we did this on the podcast, or tell her how we got. She's excited to hear the episode. So thank you everyone for listening to this episode of That's Absurd. Please elaborate. Before we wrap up, Sam, where can people come and find more of your work?
Yeah, so you can find me on all platforms at Sam J Science. And then you can also check out the podcast I exec produce called Tiny Matters. It's available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Yeah. And I've listened to several episodes in the last couple of weeks. I've been really enjoying it. So
thank you.
Definitely go check it out. Julian was at NASA last week and wasn't available to record with us. Julian, how was your NASA trip?
Incredible. The best. Imagine if like you just got to hang out with the coolest, nerdiest people and look at fighter jets for like a week straight. Yeah.
Were there French fries?
Yeah, they had fries too.
I'm into it.
Yeah, of course there were fries. I think I would say, oh, it was great, but they didn't allow French fries. I would be like, it was okay.
That seems fair.
Yeah, you know, of course there were fries. It had to be. Thanks again for listening to this episode of That's Absurd. Please elaborate. This show was created, written, and produced by me, Julian Huguet.
And me, Trace Dominguez.
And produced and edited by our wonderful and wonderfully crispy Kyle Sisk. Crispy Sisk.
Again, good band name. If you'd like to submit a question, just look for the form down in the show notes. You can go to our website, thatsabsurdshow.com/ask, or you can email us at hello@thatsabsurdshow.com. We want more questions, so please continue to submit them. We could not do this show without your input, and we really love your questions. And finally, a special, special thanks to those who are listening on Nebula. Those listeners are listening ad-free, and they get episodes that support us and other independent creators. If you want to join Nebula, visit go.nebula.tv/thatsabsurdshow.
And remember, there's no wrong way to potato, except if you listen to those health bloggers who say eat it raw. Don't do that. There is one wrong way to potato.